Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Hey, 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 welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey guys, this is Tuesday, April 30th, 2019. We're here in the studio in the back of Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. All right, we got some good guests. Everyone go around the room and introduce yourselves because we're going to have an interesting conversation with some beer bar owners and managers and experts.
This is Dan LaMonica from Beer Karma.
Hey, this is Matt from The Sampler and Uptown Beer Society.
This is Joel from The Sampler, Uptown Beer Society, and the official partners of Monica Arfair.
And it's James of Beer Acolyte.
James Ty, all right. So the reason we all came together today, and there's a couple great call-ins coming in as well, there was an article in VinePair about hashtag boss pour, which most of us kind of think is ridiculous, and most beer professionals don't really take seriously. But Dan, you know, at Beer Karma, when you opened, you know, you did a little research, and this is something that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, so I've been talking about this now for over 3 years, so it's a touch exhaustive. So it started as I was opening up Beer Karma. I was hungry for knowledge, trying to learn about the beer market, consumers, what they're doing. Noticed a trend of people when they were posting their pictures that the pours would be to the very, very tippy top of the glass with absolutely no head. So I started to reach out to a handful of people and say, hey, like, just curious, like, why are you doing that? Like, what's the purpose? And every single person that responded said, oh, I'm just doing it because the picture looks good, or it looks good for the picture. And I was just like, wait a minute. Like, I don't understand that. I thought there was some purpose it was beneficial to the beer drinking process. And it was, everyone was just hungry for likes. And you know, I've appeared on a couple podcasts, VinePair quoted me. And it's just frustrating because as a beer professional, as someone that's trying to serve great beer in my establishment, to have it be that there's a whole contingent of people that are sort of doing the complete opposite of what I'm taught and what we're supposed to be teaching people, can be frustrating. And especially when in the end of the day, they're doing something that's not about actually drinking the beer and enjoying the beer. They're doing it just to get likes on Instagram. So that's where my frustration stems.
And Joel and Matt, you guys, you don't think it's that interesting, do you?
No, it's just another trendy thing that is happening on the internet. I don't know too much about it. I've just seen it, and I think it's silly because beer needs head for aromatics. Beer needs head to be presentable.
Yeah, I got a lot of flack. I still have this screenshot saved, but it was April of 2016. I posted something on Instagram sort of saying, like, I don't understand this. This is stupid. People need to stop doing it. I also posted something on Beer Advocate, and it was kind of, the difference was the Beer Advocate people were kind of like, hey, yeah, that's silly and ridiculous. Like, you shouldn't do that. But I got a lot of hate on Instagram for it, is that people were like, you shouldn't be calling people out like this. You're an asshole, all this kind of stuff. And it was like, I don't know what to tell you, you know?
I felt the same way when I would see the Stella commercials, and they would scrape the head off of the beer, and it was just, you know, it's a marketing thing, I think, and doesn't really add to the experience of beer drinking or quality beer drinking. And
it's amazing, there's a lot of misinformation out there. I mean, James, a few years ago we did a video with, you know, you were there was some art and craft to pouring beer, and there's sure. There's definitely something that you also learn in some Cicerone training,
too, right? Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, we talked about a little bit about just like, you know, the elements of what makes, you know, for a good pour, and specifically like with the project that we were doing, it was just like the right glass, you know, choosing the right glass and the elements that and factors that went into making that decision.
And Dan, I know at Beer Karma, I mean, tell us more about your shop, because when we first had you on, you were just opening.
Yeah, so the identity of the space has definitely changed a little bit from what I had hoped it to be and what it is, in a positive way. But it's beer bar and beer store, which is kind of, it's become a pretty common model. I know the Sampler is pretty much the same thing as far as that broad concept where you can take beer to go but also sit down and drink. We do serve in both Tiku's and Willie Betcher pints are the primary service glassware. Tiku's are just expensive. I mean, as I think that they're at fantastic glassware, but they're not for everyone. establishment. I mean, even at wholesale, they can cost upwards of $10 a glass, which is, you know, very expensive, whether it's your staff or your customers breaking them. So it's, they're not for everyone. I mean, the specific glass stuff, I mean, you should avoid the American shaker pint. I mean, I think we've kind of already established that, but you know, the average bar that's just looking at margins is going to take whatever glassware they can get for free or for cheap. And if it happens to be American shaker pints that they can stack up, they're going to do that. But I like to use, they're nice because you could do multiple size pours in them. You know, you could do, the ones I have are 14 ounce glasses. So you could do a full pour as well as 8 and 5 ounce pours, look really nice in that. Whereas if I served you a pint glass with that's half full, it doesn't look very nice either. So they give you an opportunity to leave a little bit of room for aromatics. But they're versatile as well, because you could do multiple like short, half, and then full pours.
I mean, there's definitely something about, you know, certain restaurants, you know, you're getting a glass of wine and it's poured to a certain level in the glass and you kind of expect that. But a lot of times at a bar, more of a regular bar, people expect to get poured to the top. What do you guys see?
The same thing, you know, it depends on if the staff is trained and what they're doing with glassware. Us personally, we use Delirium glasses because A, they're the most stolen beer glass in the world. B, it coincides with graffiti and racking and, you know, kind of culture, and they have unlimited pallets at SKI Beer, so they bring them. You know, we use the 16.9s for the 16-ounce glass, 16-ounce cans, and then we use the 13-ounce for the large pours of like anything that's, you know, higher in margins or higher in ABV. So.
Matt,
and pouring beers, it's, I mean, we have 20 taps at the sampler, so like I know for a fact every single one of those beers pours differently, different styles of beer pour differently, different kegs will pour differently. There's no like one size fits all solution to pouring a beer. So, you know, a lot of it is adapting on the fly when it comes to pouring, especially stuff like wheat beers and saisons and certain wild beers like prairies and perennials are like sometimes a nightmare. They're delicious beers, but pouring them can be, you know, you waste a lot of beer if you don't know what you're doing. So,
well, that's one thing I love about you guys. I mean, you guys are Good Beer Seal bars. Some of you will be, and we're going to bring that back this year. But it's a very different experience, you know, having an on-premise establishment where you're pouring beer on draft and handling it. That's a different skill set than it is just getting cans and sitting at home and taking pictures of it. Do you guys want to talk about the challenges of running an on-premise establishment?
Yeah, there are challenges with on and off because people get upset at corkage fees and stuff like that. But like, you're still winning with the corkage because you're getting a 16-ounce double IPA for, what, $10-$11? And they'll still be like, why am I, is it cheaper to go? I'm like, no, this is retail. This is bar.
It's the psychology of the upcharge. I deal with the exact same thing, and I've kind of given up on it. Where even if the only way to explain it to someone is to be demeaning to them, be like, you're stupid and you don't understand it. So it's just kind of like, hey, like, it's cheaper to go. You're still getting a good deal, and you just got to try and put your hands up and let them go. But yeah, I deal with that kind of on a regular basis. That they act like I charge a $3 corkage fee, which is pretty relatively standard. And I mean, people act like I'm charging them an extra $10 to drink the beer.
Yeah, same. We charge $3 if it's under $5. We charge $2 if it's between $6 and $8, and $1 if it's at $9. So like, it's fair. I'm not gonna sell a $3 or $4 beer unless I'm trying to, you know, blow out of it, or if it was a
we try to explain to customers that we're not charging more for the beer, but we're just matching the draft price of the same beer. Usually we'll have something on in the fridge that's the same on draft, and it's easier when you give them an example like, look, this 16 ounce beer is $5 in the fridge, the same beer, a 16 ounce pour, is $8. All the corkage fee is doing is just matching, you know, those prices, and no one's winning, no one's losing. It's just, you know, beer costs what it costs.
Great, James?
True. No, very true, very true. I think, that just the prevalence of these bottle shop tap rooms that are just like, you know, exploding across the city. A lot of people just, they don't think about that corkage fee. They just kind of like see the price that's on, that sticker that's on the back of that can or that bottle, and they just come in with those expectations. But it's the same thing if you want to compare it to the wine side. You know, if you're, let's say, a BYOB restaurant, they're going to charge you a corkage fee as well. You know, but people can't make that similar kind of leap, you know, in the beer world, which is kind of strange. But that's just
the terminology too of a corkage fee versus, you know, you're just popping open a can or a bottle, and I think that's part of it too. Is that there's not the appropriate term for it yet in the beer world? Is that it's kind of catching up, and it's like, yeah, that people just don't understand. It's like, you're just opening that can for me, and it's like, you're not, the corkage fee in a restaurant isn't because people are undoing the wine bottle.
Exactly.
It's margins. It's, you got to pay rent. You got to pay for the bathroom and Wi-Fi and everything else. So
yeah, I actually just came back from London. I worked in one of the coolest craft beer bars over there called Kill the Cat. And they actually do the same thing. They call it cappage fees, but it's not unusual for, you know, a bar retail space to sell, or excuse me, to charge those fees. And then I've been kind of training some staff there and some staff here. And I find that if you give the beer value and you treat the beer like it's quality and you give the customer that value experience, they usually don't question why they're paying a certain amount for the beer. So, I mean, like things like proper head and proper glassware and, you know, rolling the can when you're pouring when you have sediment in a bottle and you, like, there's just certain things that you can do for the customer to feel like they're getting a certain value. And that's why this beer costs this much.
Great. We're going to go back to the Bospor subject. One of my favorite beer experts, Mirella Amato, is on the phone. She's a master cicerone. She's also the author of a new book that you all should check out, Beerology. Mirella, welcome to the show.
Great to finally be on. How long have we been talking about this?
Yeah, but you know, you're still in Toronto, so you know, see, you're pissed off about Bospor. You don't like it. You're worried about it affecting the industry. What's going on?
Oh, well, I think it would be a fair assessment to say that I don't like it. I actually only discovered it a few months ago. I'm not really on Instagram very much, and it really offended me. I could go ahead and put my master cicerone hat on here and talk about how it's not appropriate for and that's not how you pour beer, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, you know, thing about the boss pour is it is not a boss pour from an aesthetic perspective. I don't know if any of you fine gentlemen have ever done photo shoots with beer. I certainly did when I was putting together my book. And, you know, with a proper pour, you have a head of foam. Ideally, it's billowing up a little bit from the top of the glass. And then you step away, and you have, like, a few minutes to take that picture, maximum, before the head starts to collapse or the glass starts to frost over. And, you know, it's a huge production. Then, you know, everything's set, everything's perfect. Then, there's a reflection from the light. You have to reset that. Then now your foam's collapsed. You've got to bring your foam. It is incredibly, incredibly difficult to take a good picture of a beer that is poured properly. And I would argue that that is a boss pour. In fact, there's a photo in my book, which I consider to be a huge feat, which is, I think there's like 9 or 12 beers on the table. And we had to get them all lined up, all the foam exactly in the right place, make sure nothing was sweating. Because of course, you put a cold beer into a glass in a few minutes, it starts to sweat. You have to wipe it. By the time you've wiped it, the foam has collapsed. If you use a warmer beer, then obviously the glass doesn't frost, but then you still have issues with the foam, and you have a much smaller window because the foam is a to-do. You know, to do the boss pour, all you have to do is let the beer warm up. You can even degas it, pour it to the rim, and then take your sweet. You have like hours to take that photo. It's like a wood pour.
Here, let Dan jump in, because you're saying you could actually pour flat beer and take
a
photo.
No, so wait, it was a couple of quick comments. So, Mirella, I think part of that is, I think it's the ease. Most of these people that are doing this, they're sort of amateur, at-home beer drinkers, and I think it is out of ease that they started to do this. But I wanted to ask, because you said you did that one photo with 9 beers across. I've heard of breweries using milk frothers before doing photos like that, when they had to take, you know, 9 beers across. Like, I could take a picture of 1 or 2 beers with an inch of head, but 9 is very difficult. Did you have any other tricks that you did in order to sort of have that work out properly?
Yeah, so I've been actually on a number of shoots, and there were a few where the stylist put some kind of, it wasn't milk froth, I think one of them put egg whites in the foam. Another one had some kind of special chemical that they could throw in, but then it starts leaking out of the bottom. You get these streams coming through the beer, and then you have to throw out the whole thing. When I did that picture, it was just me being quick with chopsticks.
you gotta post that photo and send it to us, okay? Yeah.
Me and Joel actually have a trick.
Here's Matt. He's got a trick.
We actually will grab either a bar stirrer or a straw, and we'll just kind of swirl it around really quickly in the glass, and that usually builds the head back up in seconds.
Yeah, I'll one up you there. Chopsticks are even more effective for some reason. I believe it's because of the there's more nucleation, because if you just get takeout chopsticks, they're very uneven. And that allows you to get, even when there's like just a drop of carbonation in there, you can give it a good stir. I don't know, you know, that for me, you know, those pours clearly aren't meant to be consumed. They're meant to be looked at. But I look at those, and especially the ones that are New England IPAs, like, I'm not even convinced that's beer. That could be orange juice. So it's just confusing to me that this has become a boss.
I think what
boss implies awesomeness.
What's become most confusing to me is that, you know, I think I've said I have a responsibility, and so do you guys, Joel and Matt, as far as you're presenting great beer, and as you as well, Morella, and there are now breweries that are doing this as well. So if the breweries are sort of doing this as well with their own photographs in order to do this boss pour, they're not necessarily taking care of their beer and presenting it in the best way possible. Where does that leave us? You know what I mean? I'm buying these really expensive kegs, and then I'm supposed to be pouring them a proper way, but then the brewery's representing their beer totally different. So it's kind of you're at a little bit of a crossroads of, do you just stick to your guns of, this is how I'm trained, this is how I know I'm supposed to serve beer? Or do you just kind of say, you know what, if the breweries are doing this and everyone else is doing it, like, why bother at some point?
I mean, at some point, you know, it's like, marketing kind of like leads the way and what sells. I mean, 5 or 6 years ago, Spiegelau rolled out these custom glassware. There was the IPA glass, the stout glass, the wheat beer glass. There were special tastings and we did shows with them. And Morella, I'm sure you were part of all those. And, you know, you kept thinking, wow, this is the next standard. And guys like Taurus and Beer Karma have the Teku glasses. I thought that there was a new standard being set, but maybe we can't stick to standards. I don't know.
Yeah.
Let James come in.
Okay?
James in.
No, it's all right.
Hey, James.
Hey, Maria, how are you doing?
Great, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. So, you know, I wanted to get your perspective. We talked about the boss pour. We've talked about, you know, like, you know, what that means in today's kind of ethos and in the landscape. So, you know, speaking as one of the 18 master cicerones in existence today, what would you say is probably the prettiest beer that you see in a glass? You know, like, what would be your perspective on that?
Well, when I look at a photo of a beer, I want to see the light streaming through that beer, to really get a sense of the nuances of color that can be in a beer. You know, the center is going to be a different color than the edges. I want a nice head of foam, and as I mentioned earlier, I want it billowing out the top, even if it's dripping a little on the side, but that's like a super boss color. That's an incredible part to put well.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, that's what I want to see. Beyond that, of course, if the beer is a specific beer, then it should be in the appropriate glass. And I don't think, you know, we need to get super fancy. I know the Teku was mentioned and the Spiegelau glasses and so on and so forth. I think as long as the glass is appropriate to the style, and, you know, some styles don't have foam, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But I want to see something that is appropriate. And that was also a huge to-do with my book, because, you know, photos would come back. And I'm sure you've all had this issue with, you know, pamphlets or publications or textbooks that you put together, and, you know, they pull out stock images. And it's like, this page is about porters. That beer is yellow. It's not going to work out.
Yeah. So Morella, hold on a second. Just give another shout out, Morella Amato. New book's out, Beerology. Thank you for calling in. Stay on with us, but we're just going to keep talking, go out a little further. Joel?
I'm all about presentation, and I feel like, as much as I respect the Cicerone program and what all the professionals and people that know more than me and have more experience do, I feel like everyone finds their own niche. I'm all about presentation, like I said. So sometimes if something doesn't have head retention, I will rough pour it first. If I have 4 or 5 glasses, I will rough pour all the foam first, and then I will top it off at a 45-degree angle so everything is presented equally at the same time. I will also over pour over the glass, so by the time the customer gets it, the foam is about probably 2 inches in the glass and another inch outside, more or less half an inch. So by the time they get back from the bathroom or with their phone out to take a photo, it's right at the rim, because at Taproom 307, when we were really busy and I was a server, we would bust glasses and we would have to top off everything. So I learned maybe I should over pour out the glass foam, so by the time the server gets it or the customer, it's perfectly at the rim. So I feel like everybody finds their own niche or gateway into presence.
So that's a great point. Yeah. In the reality of actually serving, yeah, half the time, by the time you take the beers to a table, it's settled and it looks like you don't have a full glass.
Exactly. My pet peeve is someone will order a beer from me and I pour a perfect pour and they walk to the bathroom. And by the time they get out the bathroom, it's completely flat. So I usually keep an eye out for someone who's like, I have another beer, and they take off, and I just kind of pour their beer halfway, and I wait for them to get back to finish the pour.
Or relevant to this conversation, someone that will just whip out their phone and Instagram that picture of your beautiful beer, you know, well, before they drink
it. But you know what? If I'm out, I'm out with a good beer and I've got a date, I'm not looking at my phone, gentlemen.
Hey.
Dan?
No, I'm throwing my hands up at your joke, not at no comment.
Well, that's the other thing, but another thing I'm going to give a shout out to, New York City, good Brazil bars and really good craft beer bars and bottle shops. I really feel like that people go there to actually talk to people and drink. You know, I feel like there's a different market where you're at home and you've got this can. And I know a lot of guys that listen, and I feel bad for you guys because, I mean, it's great to be home. And thank God there's a good can you can have a beer at home. But I would much rather be out in one of these bars like the Sampler or Beer Karma talking to people. And so cheers to you guys.
Cheers.
And for what you do, because it's a lot of extra work, you know. And if you don't know what it's like, you know, I feel like the can business has really changed the game. Even you guys having cans, talking about worrying about a corkage fee to pour. For a while, it was like craft beer bars only had draft. That's what it seemed like. So there's a lot of interesting changes that have happened, right? Since, I don't know, even the last 5 years.
You got
guys.
Delirium 16.9s. You got all these German breweries on 16.9s. You got everyone canning overseas.
The international markets are canning because for the American market. And then craft breweries, too. Allagash cans are hitting New York City this week. They were a brewery that would have never canned 10 years ago, and now that's what they're doing. I mean, I was going to joke. The irony, I say we're a bottle shop, but 80% of what I have in the fridge, if not more than that, is in cans for packaged stuff. That's what people want to buy. I turn down buying things that are in 12-ounce bottles. Or when people say, the cans are coming soon, it's like, I'll wait for cans, because if I put 12-ounce bottles in the fridge, they're just not going to sell for me.
Morella, are you seeing any trends about that? You know, cans and other things. I know that you travel a lot as a master cicerone.
Trends in terms of cans versus bottles?
Sure. If you're thinking about it, if not, we'll move on to another subject.
Each area is different. That's a broad question.
No,
I did want to go back, however, to a statement that was made earlier, getting back to the boss board, because I do have to hop off in a second. But, first of all, I think it's amazing what everyone was talking about doing to really secure a nice pour. And I'm feeling you all in terms of, you know, you've made a beer look amazing. Then that person pops off to the washroom, comes back, and takes a picture. It's like, oh, could have been better. But going back to, you know, what was said about breweries picking this up from marketing, I think that is extremely dangerous. I mean, first of all, they're throwing money out the window. Because if you're pouring a beer to the rim, that's not the way it's meant to be poured. So that space that should be foam, that is beer, you know, we're talking about probably about 10 cents per pint that you're just throwing out. And to set that standard is just, it's baffling. And then compounded by, I think it was Dan who mentioned earlier, the fact that, you know, as an industry, we have been working so hard to promote the proper way for beer, which, will save some money, but also really increases the enjoyment of that beer by, you know, releasing the aromas. I'm preaching to the converted here and, ensuring that beer isn't over-carbonated. And we've come so far with that education. And to see, if Instagram people want to do silly things, that's great. But to see brewers hopping on that trend with their marketing and tap rooms, I think that's really, it's problematic. And again, just throwing money out the window. What are you doing?
Great. Thanks so much for calling in, Morella, Beerology.
Thanks, Morella.
Dan, what were you going to say just before that?
It's always interesting. I mean, Joel mentioned to talk to someone like Morella, who's a master cicerone. You know what I mean? That there's just sort of another level of knowledge about beer service, beer pouring, and just beer quality. And those are the people that we should be listening to. You know what I mean? That's who we should be sort of taking account from, and let their voices be heard, because they know what they're talking about.
And what goals do you guys have? I mean, you guys are all like kind of at the top of your game, trying to do a good job serving, getting the best craft beers. Just tell me some of the things that you guys want to do going forward?
One of our main objectives, especially at the sampler or with like our group Uptown Beer Society, is kind of educating people on beer, beer styles, you know, how to drink and taste certain beers and enjoy beer. You know, we want to teach them about aromas and head retention and tasting and finish. And we just feel that the more people are educated about beer, the less it becomes just a thing that you crush. You know, it's interesting that people have this like consciousness about what food they consume, and like they want to eat better, or like when it's spirits, they want to drink the more expensive spirits. But when it comes to beer, unfortunately, a lot of people think that cheap is the way to go, or low quality. But we're trying to just change people and give them a more like self-awareness that you could drink better and you should drink better.
Yeah, yeah, I think the key to that too is just doing that in a way to not insult people too, because you see a lot of people that they come in like really highbrow and like really try to like, you know, lay out some esoteric terms, and you know, you're not going to win people over by doing that. Sure. And I know like no one in this room, you know, really kind of adheres to that kind of philosophy, but when you see it out on the streets, you know, and it's typically it's not even the beer professional that's doing it, it's just like someone that's like really really into his passion, you know, his or her passion, I'm sorry, which is a great thing too, but in many ways it does a disservice to the people who are just really trying to learn more about this stuff.
Dan, you brought in the first beer. What is it?
First beer we're drinking is Lounge from Finback. It was their spring saison. It was a dry hop saison. I believe the dry hop was Equinot and Citra. It's really nice. It's pretty low ABV for a saison. It's 5.5% alcohol, but it's kind of like a light, easy drinking beer for spring. So this has been a favorite of mine in the shop.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's got like these like kind of like lemon notes to it, like really citrus forward.
Yeah.
Back to piggyback on what you guys are saying. I mean, the goal is to just, you know, find comfort in people and kind of find where they're, where people come in and say, I don't like beer. That is your chance to be like, do you like sour candy? Do you like dessert? What do you like? What have you enjoyed? Oh, I guess, you know, I'll drink a Stella. There you go, a Pils. Every now and then a Blue Moon. There you go. Let me get a wit. And it's just about educating them, like us being from the Bronx and growing up with all people of all different walks of life and cultures. We kind of learn how to like, kind of be chameleons when we talk, or you know, when we connect with people. So you know, whether that person comes in of any culture, we can just switch it up from the most, you know, geekiest white dude to like the most hoodiest black dude. Like we can connect with all, and people like us are very important because they're more inclined to listen to us and respect what we got to
say. That's great. We're going to talk more about that. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world. Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're talking about proper pouring, you know, service and good bars and the boss pour. So Joel and Matt, Uptown Beer Society and the sampler, you guys were talking about how you educate people and selling people by style.
So yeah, it starts at the grassroots of what they like. So, you know, it's pretty easy. It's good to find a connection between a beer. It's good to learn what the macros are, the Angry Orchards, the Stellas, the Guinness, the Blue Moon. All those beers will help you try to connect a person. Even down to the maltier stuff like Four Loko that people drink, like it's or a 40. Like what does that taste like? Why do they like that? And trying to, you know, find their niche. And if it's not beer, what do they like? Do they like spicy, sweet, savory? And you can connect the beer off of that.
Matt.
Yeah, the worst thing you can do is be pretentious. especially when you're working in a craft beer bar, about someone who doesn't know the microbrew. I mean, it makes total sense. You see billboards for all the Coronas and the Coors and the Blue Moons. You don't see billboards for microbreweries. You know, so it's totally understandable that that's the style that people are advertising. That's the style they know.
Great. Our special guest, Julia Hertz from the Brewers Association Colorado, is on the line. Hello, Julia.
Hi, everybody.
How are you doing?
Julia.
Good. I want to just get, we're talking about Bosworth, but I want to talk more about what Matt and Joelle were just talking about. You know, if you look at, it seems like the big challenge is there's a lot of beer sales. Still, most people are drinking macros and non-craft. You know, would you talk to them about their strategy about how to get more people turned on to craft beer and other strategies like that that the Brewers Association is putting out there?
I love the answer of don't be pretentious and keeping it fun. Beer is fun. It's accessible. It's an affordable luxury. So that's a great place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things we for the sampler, it's like that's our base. But with Uptown Beer Society, we really get a chance to be out there in the streets and bring the beer and the fun and the craft to the people.
Yeah, and it starts with history, too. Like, we go back to Egypt and Africa. Black females in Africa were the first brewers. And when a person with African that is African-American with African roots hears that, they're like, wait, what, really? And it's like, yes, we created this thing, and we all deserve to drink better, and you deserve to drink better. This isn't pretentious. This isn't hipster. This doesn't have a color.
That's great. And Julie, we were talking earlier about also the Boss Pour. So Dan's here from Beer Karma, which is a great beer bar in Brooklyn. And we had some conversations about it. That's why I asked you to call in. So do you want to talk about that? Serving beer, pouring beer, proper pour, anything along those lines?
Yeah, and it's such an important part of it because the carbonation, which is great with pairing, scrubs the tongue, gets us, you know, gets us ready for the next bite. It's something that also you don't want to ingest too much of it. So if you're pouring a beer, whether it's from draft, right, or the bottle or the can, pouring it into a glass has you literally intaking physically less carbonation. And so that fills you up less. So drink your beer out of a glass. Plus you get the benefits when you pour it into a glass of more aromatics, and that enhances the flavor. So there's that. And when you pour, if you want to try for a perfect, beautiful pour, then go for that proper collar of foam, hold your glass at 45-degree angle, open the faucet, or, you know, pour your beer down the side of the glass for about two-thirds of the pour, and then straighten up that glass and let it cascade down the middle and fall to the bottom, and that's going to kind of exacerbate that collar of foam and get those beautiful aromatics to go into the air and to be appreciated.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you so much for that, because that's something that literally I figured out on my own, and I wasn't sure if it was like the proper thing to do, but it's amazing to hear that coming from you.
No, I mean, there are little tricks you can do that. I mean, I sometimes have trouble. Like on Monday nights, we've got a running group, and I feature a particular beer, and sometimes that means that I'm pouring 20 to 25 pints in a row of the same beer, and because that beer that's coming out of the keg is very, very cold, I've got short lines, I've got a direct draw. You have to agitate the beer a little bit, so I'll kind of, as I'm pouring, swirl the beer a little bit. Otherwise, you will get zero head. So there are little tricks that you figure out, especially because pouring from a draft system versus a can versus a bottle is totally different, but there are little things that you can do, and it is like it's a very good point. Like, we're talking about presentation, but there are legitimate ways from it, from an actual consumption and an aromatics point of view, why you want the head on the beer as it's served.
Yeah, I feel like there's no rules. That's how craft was created, right? Just taking a risk, trying your own thing.
Great line.
It's a good group of guys here, Julia. You know, we called you because you really are. Just tell us more about your role for the Brewers Association, because these guys are here at the forefront of serving and selling beer in New York City. But I feel like that not all beer bars get to connect with the Brewers Association.
Sure. I'm talking today from Boulder, Colorado. We are the national nonprofit group that represents the majority of breweries in the U.S. We've been around in different iterations since 1942, when small brewers got together to secure tin for bottle caps 1978, Charlie Papazian started the American Homebrewers Association, and then we blossomed from there. And what a cool job to work with amazing people like you guys and beer lovers and distributors and brewers and really advance the beverage of beer, which was mass-produced lager, you know, pre-1980s and kind of a dismal time. And now you get people literally making a living like me and you guys and half your listeners that get so much enjoyment out of beer. And kind of back to the beginning of the conversation that I got to listen to you guys saying, you know, beer teaches us geography, it teaches us history, it teaches us sensory and flavor, it teaches us about ourselves. Because if you dive in to what you really like flavor-wise, and then you start to get to know the story behind the producer and where the beer originated and where the ingredients originated, there's just so many places to go.
Absolutely.
Nice. Hey, Julia. As my favorite craft beer director at the Brewers Association, I want to know, like, and just tying everything together here, what, in terms of, like, you know, obviously we have a room here of a lot of, you know, like, just people that are working in the on-premise side of things. So they're dealing a lot with draft systems and just pouring for consumers. So what are some of the things that you see out there that people are doing wrong, you know, in terms of, serving beer that would lead to something like a boss pour, you know, at your local that we don't want?
Yeah, I mean, especially on draft, I see a lot of challenges. You just sit at the bar, at bar A, B, or C in any market in the country, you're going to see things that as a beer lover and, you know, beer educator make you cringe. You know, you don't want to take it too seriously, but it's not great when you get a dirty glass. This round program just had, you know, Beer Clean Glass Day on April 27th, and there's a reason. If we had carbonation in our food, then we would see how much we are, you know, consuming and being exposed to on the plate, right? We have residual sanitizer and lipstick and terrible things. And I always say, I don't want to be exposed. I want to get intimate with my beer, but I don't want to be exposed to the previous affairs of who also enjoyed beer from that glass. And it's really gross. So we just can't get clean glassware. Wine would never. You know, it's rare that you see not clean glassware. Maybe a little minerality from the water is residual on some glasses, but I'm talking wherever you see bubbles on the inside of the glass that are gathering, that's a glass that has not been properly cleaned at that spot, and who knows what you're consuming. So bars got to get it right there. That's number one, beer clean glass.
And if you don't see clean glass, you got to imagine what the lines look like.
Yeah, they're not necessarily paying attention. And we wrote the book at the Brewers Association. I'm holding in front of me the draft beer quality manual that big brewers and small brewers got together. This is in the fourth edition. It's now physically a book. More than 100,000 copies of this are out in the space. And it really talks about the importance of line cleaning every 2 weeks with caustic, every 3 months with acid clean, and then properly rinsing those lines and really making sure that you also get at the stainless components, your couplers and your faucets. And that is key. And it's just like being a restaurant and properly cleaning, you know, your dishes, properly cleaning your sink, properly cleaning your stove, properly cleaning your fridge. But for some reason, beer lines just get forgotten. And so we are all working to make that not be a forgotten task.
Julia, I don't want to give you nightmares, but have you ever seen on Instagram the Draft Police NYC page?
Oh, man.
No, but I'll check it out. I bet there's some crazy pictures.
They're part of the Draft Choice team where they do both installations as well as cleanings. And he will do it anonymously. He won't call out the bars and restaurants, but you will That's see good. Keg couplers and faucets that are, oh, they look like just SCOBY colonies. It's gross in the sense of you can't imagine that someone took that coupler off of one keg and put it onto another and thought it was okay. And then, yeah, to your point, it's we talked about the boss bar and all that silly stuff. But at the end of the day, if you're drinking out of a dirty glass or dirty tap lines, you're not in a good place anyway. So how you're pouring the beer is important, but the cleanliness of all of your hardware is key.
And Matt, you kind of perked up when he mentioned the Draft Police on Instagram.
Yeah, I could just imagine what, you know, I so often will suspect that a bar is not cleaning their lines, and I, you know, not to be insulting, I'll just, you know, drink it out of the bottle or the can just to be on the safe side.
I mean, I'll tell you honestly, for me, it's one reason why I only used to go drink draft beer at places that I knew really well, and that's why we had the good beer seal for a lot of these bars, because I've been to places where I walk in, still to this day, I walk in, it's like, oh, it looks like a pub, there's going to be some beers on draft. I see some brands that I know, I would think that this would be good, and instantly, you can just tell the lines haven't been cleaned. And sometimes I almost feel like those are the kind of bars that aren't even moving those beers, which makes it even worse. And they might be moving the macro line. So there's something else going on as well where they're just not paying attention to their craft portfolio.
Yeah, and that's what a boss pour is. A boss pour is when you go to a dive bar and they literally rough pour your beer and it comes to the rim with no head because the glass is dirty and the lines are gross. So there you go, guys. That's what a boss pour is.
Yeah, and a lot of it comes down to staff. I mean, especially... You know, what you said, especially about beers being neglected. If a beer is sitting there for weeks or months at a time, you know, that means the staff is not, they're not educated on what that beer is or the style is or how to sell it to a certain customer. We always say at the sampler, we're not just beer servers, we're beer sellers. And we try to really, you know, pay attention to every draft line, every beer, make sure everything moves, you know, at an appropriate amount of time.
Julia, is there anything to help us out with this? I mean... You guys are solidly behind breweries and the craft beer industry. But the next step, you know, on-premise, you know, serving a beer, you know, there's Cicerone. But is there anything that the Brewers Association is doing or might be doing in the future to help recognize, you know, beer bars that are really outstanding or other best practices?
Well, Beer Bars Outstanding, craftbeer.com, our beer lover-facing website, which gets millions of viewers a year, is really incredible, and we publish now multiple years in a row the Great American Beer Bars, and it recognizes, voted by craftbeer.com visitors, thousands of them voting, their favorite beer bars in each state. So check that out. Certainly a good one. And I would say that the impetus back to kind of bar practices of properly cleaned glassware, properly cleaned draft systems, the impetus isn't just on the retailer because it is a lack of awareness. The authorities and experts in beer are the distributors and the brewers themselves. And so we've done everything from encourage brewers to put date codes on their beers, which we are front and center about. So the freshness factor is there, but it goes to service. And when it goes to service, we have to help those retail accounts. And there's 750,000 accounts that have beverage alcohol licenses in the U.S. in some form, to know about needing to clean their draft lines and to store their beer cold so it stays fresh. And so, you know, the distributors are the ones in and out of those accounts delivering that beer that they've sold, and they have a great chance to continue to educate, but sometimes it can certainly be an overwhelming battle. But we need to do all we can to empower distributors and brewers to have all the ammunition to then properly educate the retailer.
You know, and some places and some days, it used to be or can be the responsibility of certain distributors to clean the lines. I know there's different rules in different states. I don't know if anyone wants to talk about that, you know, just how far a brewery or distributor will go to ensure that its beer is served properly.
It depends on that. I'm sorry, Daniel.
No.
It depends on that salesman, honestly, because the distributor could – a lot of these – kids are moving to New York and they're looking for work and they get into a beer distributor and they don't know much and then they're trained. And there's other kids like me who was passionate growing up in the Bronx and got into beer because of Bronx Ale House and ended up at SKI Beer and had a mission statement to evolve beer in the Bronx and walk through every territory and kind of educate. That was my mission, but not everyone has that mission. So it's a personal thing, man. People could be trained up to par and they still will follow incentives. There's brewery incentives. You get more money for selling certain cases, like especially Manhattan Beer and AB and distributors like that who have huge incentives and their craft portfolio just pushes down. So this comes from heart and a person.
Well, I've seen the opposite where you get a really good brewery rep and they'll come in and they'll see that their beer's not pouring right and they'll actually go back to the keg room and help you adjust it. I don't know if you have that.
No, there's other instances of that. I've, you know, people will say if a beer's not super fresh, they'll buy a keg back, or not really necessarily a keg, but they'll swap out kegs. They'll buy cans back. There's definitely, I think it's illegal in New York for distributors and breweries to pay to have your lines cleaned. So that's not necessarily the case. But there's definitely, there should be a care. It's not necessarily always going to be the case, but I think breweries do want their beer poured properly. I've heard instances of breweries taking kegs back because it was stale beer, IPAs and specifically where it was a local brewery where a bar had bought a keg and just sat on it for months and then posted, oh, XYZ IPA on tap. And they're like, wait a minute, that was from December. Why are you tapping that at the beginning of May? And they went and took it back from them. So there's definitely a focus on it, but it, at some point you got to sell beer. So you can't be on the ground at every single account all the time, managing all of their tap lines. So, but it's trying to sort of push for that. I know that my distributor reps will talk about dirty lines and know that certain bars are notorious for that, but there's only so much that they can do, you know?
Yeah. It's up to the four tier. I mean, people say three tier. I think there's four tiers. There's the distro, there's the actual, you know, well, the import distro, and then there's the account, and then there's the actual people that work there, because those are the final brand ambassadors that are either going to make or break that brand or that beer.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely comes down to education about, you know, like, why is this beer not pouring the way it should be? Why is this beer not tasting the way that it should be? And so, you know, getting back to your point, Joel, is just to have that passion to learn about, like, you know, where these things are coming from and to troubleshoot that. And, you know, back to the Brewers Association, that draft quality manual is invaluable when it comes to that. And so I personally really recommend that piece of literature to everybody that works on All Progress.
Yeah, absolutely. Because a bartender, I always say, is a dime a dozen. You know, you can find many bartenders, but people who actually care about beer or educated about beer or are passionate about sharing what they know about beer, those are the true gems.
Well, just one, Joel, I like what you said, that bad beer or beer that wasn't in a clean glass or clean lines is what comes out as a boss pour.
That's what it is.
you want to end on that note, Julius, what do you think of that boss pour trend? And, you know, what do you think, is it impacting what consumers are expecting from a tap room?
You know, we've never surveyed deep enough, I think, to know anything that gets to the level of desired collar of foam, that kind of sensory. But we definitely know the top things that beer lovers want, at least that we've surveyed or Nielsen surveyed, is freshness. Freshness is definitely, year in and year out, continued to be the top. And if you think about American IPA, which is the number one selling style from U.S. craft brewers, at least, you know, freshness is essential. So we really need, it's hit or miss at retail. We really need, as beer lovers, to take our money to retailers and support the retailers that maybe call it the fifth tier, right? That get beer and get proper beer service. But it's not an overnight thing that's going to be solved.
Julia, can you send a note out to all the West Coast breweries to stop stressing shelf stability of their IPAs then, and do a little more of the 6 week thing that we do in New York and in the East Coast for the hazy IPAs?
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah,
what's going on?
I mean,
just throwing a little bit of shade. Sorry,
the expiration on it.
IPA shelf life is not determined. Shelf life is a relative thing, but certainly it's been proven that with temperature and time, beers are, I wouldn't call it less stable, I would call them, they are going through a cycle, a flavor cycle, and they're less fresh. So that's certainly something. And, you know, Sierra Nevada Pale Ale has 150-day shelf life, and they back that. So, and that's very, you know, aromatic-centric hop beer. So shelf life's a little bit relative, but I definitely think sell-through is key, and establishments that are stocking, you know, aromatic-centric beers that are very hop-centric need to pay attention to the sell-through and the time that beer has been available, and also store it cold.
Yeah, if you like a malty IPA, I'm not mad at you, but I'd much rather see a kegged on date or a canned date or a bottled on date.
And the last thing, you know, if we're going down that road too, it's also about how fast you make your beer, you know? I mean, it seems like breweries can turn out IPAs faster and faster. And generally, I don't think those beers last as long, but there's definitely a knack for taking your time with beer too. So there's a lot of things to learn and to talk about. James, anything else for Julia?
Oh, no, I wanted to talk a little bit more about what you were talking about with glycosidic bonds, hop creep, and but that's a little bit too technical for where we're going right now. Julie, what is kind of like on the Brewers Association's kind of like the horizon in terms of different initiatives that are coming out with regards to, just the beer serving and just the quality of beer and kind of upholding those standards?
I love those standards, and we just had our technical committee, which we almost have 90 brewery members involved in our technical team. They have a summit every other year. We've done this 6 years now, so three times, and they just met and talked about the priorities from the brewer side of what we as their association should work on. And technical covers many things. It covers sensory. It covers draft systems. We have ambassadors devoted to draft beer quality and, you know, teaching and instruction on that. We have an incredible amount of resources devoted to hop research and barley research. So technical also can cover safety, sustainability of brewers, raw materials and sourcing. The list really goes on bigger than just what we're working on initiative wise in terms of beer service, but that is on the list. And it's certainly something that we continue to have resources on. The main website that we publish all of our information on is brewersassociation.org or craftbeer.com. And then even on the homebrewers side, homebrewersassociation.org, we pay attention to supporting that community. And there's more than 1 million active homebrewers in the U.S. So a lot of good stuff. We'll be in D.C. for Savor soon, which is sold out. Love that. That's a May event. Beer and food pairing is big. Advancing beer at retail isn't just selling beer. We can now see from Nielsen data that more beer occasions happen with food than with not. So beer and food pairing is a huge interest of ours to also advance.
Great. Nice. Julia, thanks so much for joining us. Guys, if you want to wrap it up, I know, Joel, you guys have some pretty interesting things coming up. Art related?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk a few about some things that we got coming up. Today we finally announced our third collaboration with Interborough Spirits and Ales, which an artist from Queens called Skewville did the can art. It's basically a limited edition can of Premier, which is going to be released and available for people. I want Dan to have first grabs on it. I want Harlem Hops and Bronx Beer Hall to have first dabs on it. We'll also be March 1st through 5th in NoHo, 718 Broadway, for one of the biggest contemporary art fairs in the world, Moniker Art Fair. We will be doing a pop-up of what the Sampler and Uptown Beer Society embodies in the basement. So we are offering all free tickets to anybody. We're all about community and giving back. So these tickets start at $15 and end up at $75. So just hit me up at UptownAles@gmail.com or message me on Instagram, Uptown_Ales, and I'll send you a link. Also, shout outs to Beer Culture, who released his book. We are the only retailer for his book in NYC. It's an informative book about beer styles. He's from the Bronx and more like touching people and not being pretentious. And, you know, for new beer drinkers or people that live in the hood, he wrote a book.
What's his handle? Beer Culture.
Beer Culture with a K.
Just Beer Culture.
With a K, no C's. Also, we have a Barrier collab coming up in June and a big punk hardcore show at Hunts Point at a venue called The Point, which is a cross collab with Brewski's Bar and Grill, Bronx Beer Hall, The Sampler, Uptown Beer Society, kind of focusing on what Bronx culture was. It wasn't just hip hop. There was punk, hardcore, metal, and ska in the Bronx. So we're doing a big show to give back to the kids. We're doing a can release there and a draft release June 8th in the Bronx. And I'm ecstatic. Matt's going to work on a ton of stuff in London, launching London Beer Society, working with some partners out there, which things will be told on the internet. So stay tuned. I mean, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think you nailed it pretty much. But yeah, check us out at Uptown Beer Society.
Cheers to you guys. You guys are real new leaders of the craft beer community in New York City. I really appreciate it when you came on recently with the Interborough, the Dead President collaboration. That was my favorite beer of the winter, the Vienna Lager that you guys made. So great, great work, guys.
Thank you.
And Dan, you know, Beer Carmenal, you're 2 years old. You're really another strong presence in the New York City craft beer scene.
2 years in, we're actually going to celebrate on June 1st for our second annual keg party. Try and keep it a little more chill and relaxed for our anniversary parties for our regulars and people that are part of our community. So that'll be a lot of fun. And then May 6th, we're launching Night Shift Night Light. And then May 20th, we're launching the Allagash Can. So we got a couple of fun events coming up as well.
That's great. And James?
No, I'm just an old crank that's like, you know, really inspired by, you know, this, the new guard that's coming in. And I look forward to having like my next round over at Beer Karmer and the sampler.
So what didn't we talk about? You started mentioning Beer Creep and some other
Hop
stuff.
Creep. No, that's for the next show. That's for another the next show. We'll talk about that later.
All right. Well, you guys, thanks for joining in, everybody. Thank you, Joel, Matt, Dan, James, and for calling in, Julia and Morella. This is Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Big shout out to our producer, Justin Kennedy, engineer, Matt Patterson, assistant producer, intern, Aaliyah Pipes. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Nice. Woo.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Diane Stemple.
And I'm Elena Santigade, and we're the hosts of Cutting the Curd here on Heritage Radio Network. Featuring interviews with makers and mongers and everybody in between, this show is a downright funky look at the world of artisan cheese.
You can find Cutting the Curd wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.